thank you very much for asking me to come and talk at this interesting meeting. First, to start with a disclaimer, I'm a medical oncologist, and the perspective that I'm going to bring to this meeting is predominantly from one of trying to develop novel therapeutic agents in a clinical setting. I guess the other question that I should ask John Hunter, who's just walked in, is whether what sort of quadrant I fit on after the end of this talk in terms of looking at the barking dog model. Just to give a background in terms of cancer statistics, there are about 140,000 cases of cancer that are diagnosed in Canada each year, and about half of those patients will die because of the cancer. And on average, each month, there are about 2,600 Canadians who die with cancer. It's the leading cause of premature death in Canada, being responsible for about 31% of all potential life years lost. So what's an oncologist doing here at a mathematical meeting? I guess the goal of a medical oncologist and somebody who's involved in drug development is to try and improve on cancer therapy. And what I wanted to do is illustrate what we're involved with in terms of looking at novel therapeutics, particularly in a cancer such as ovarian cancer, focusing a little bit on what type of tumor growth patterns we deal with, and then focusing on sort of what we deal with all the time, which is systemic therapy of tumors, looking at chemotherapy and how we can potentially overcome drug resistance, which is the barrier to successful therapy, and moving into molecularly targeted therapy, which is where systemic therapy is actually going right now in oncology. And asking the question of this group at the end, which is there a way of looking at mathematical modeling as perhaps the foundation for intelligent design of therapeutic trials, looking at complex system modeling? So in terms of ovarian cancer, again, there are about 2,500 cases of ovarian cancer each year in Canada, and half of these women will die of the cancer. Unfortunately, ovarian cancer is often detected quite late. It's very asymptomatic in its early stages. And by the time patients are diagnosed, most women have fairly bulky, widespread disease. That's sad, considering if it was diagnosed early, a lot of those women would be potentially curable. Patients who are diagnosed with bulky disease often have a five-year survival of less than 10%. Paradoxically, the majority of these women, 70 to 80% of these women, will respond extremely well to chemotherapy, at least initially. However, the disease in most of these women will recur over a period of a year or two, and the median survival of these women is usually only about 3 years. And that's why there's an urgent need for novel therapies. This is a fairly gory picture, and I apologize for this, but this illustrates more than anything else that I could say what the scale of the problem is. This is typical for someone who is diagnosed with ovarian cancer. The cancer is widespread throughout the peritoneal cavity in multiple different areas, and therefore it's very difficult to actually resect it completely, and therefore treatment approaches have to be systemic. They have to deal with all of the different areas where there is disease. In terms of trying to look at anti-cancer drugs, the way we approach development of anti-cancer drugs is through a rigorous process of evidence-based evaluation. Looking at the drug itself, obviously we have to look at the mechanism of action, the mode of administration of the drug, the basic pharmacology, and the tolerability and cytotoxicity of the drug, and also what cancer is being treated. Sequentially, clinical trials are conducted to assess the safety, tolerability, and activity of the agent. And if in these sequential trials there is promising activity, the trials are expanded to try and compare with the standard of care till that point. That's a fairly long process. And from the time a novel agent is identified, and often the time that you actually hear about these agents in the press saying that there's a promising new development from cancer, to the time that it actually comes into the clinical setting to demonstrate efficacy is often 10 years or longer. The process at which we're predominantly involved is in the human trials, which is basically taking new drugs from a preclinical setting and trying to design these clinical trials, going through a series of early phase clinical trials, to try and demonstrate efficacy. So the preclinical demonstration of activity based on animal studies as well as in vitro studies often takes anywhere from 2 to 5 years after identification of a novel interesting compound. And at this stage, pharmaceutical companies will often be identifying hundreds, if not thousands, of compounds every year. However, only a minority of these compounds will actually make it into a clinical setting. And the purpose of early phase clinical trials, the phase one clinical trials, is to basically make sure that the compound that you're going to be looking at is safe to use in humans. And so the predominant endpoint of these trials is to make sure that the drug is safe, to establish a dose with which we can start human trials, and then gradually escalate. The paradigm has been that we take a drug, give it at a very, very low dose, and give it to the maximum tolerated dose in humans before we actually take further studies. So that's establishing the maximum tolerated dose in humans. We base the design of these clinical trials based on any clues from the preclinical models and from the animal pharmacology. And this is where there is a little bit of experience, a little bit of guesswork, and you hope for luck in terms of picking out the schedules with which to go with, because you can only choose a number of different clinical trial strategies, because the most precious commodity in these clinical trials are patients, and you only want to start a few clinical trials at a time. If the compound in phase one testing shows safety and tolerability, and if there is a glimmer of hope in terms of activity, we will move on to phase two clinical trials, which is basically taking a uniform population of patients, let's say with ovarian cancer, and treating them all with a uniform schedule of treatment with a uniform dose to try and see if this drug is active or not. And this period will typically take another couple of years as well. If there is sort of reasonable activity from phase two clinical trials, then we move on to phase three clinical trials, which is basically trying to really validate whether this drug is a promising drug in ovarian cancer or not, trying to compare it with the standard of care, which would be in a phase three setting with a randomized comparison with the standard treatments. And this phase would take hundreds of patients and often may go on for 3 to 4 years. So the entire process of phase one to phase three clinical trials may take about 6 to 7 years. And the challenge that we have is that we want to optimize anti-cancer drug design, and moving from the basic early phase clinical trials to the clinical setting as quickly as possible. However, we're going through a major shift right now. Until recently, we've been basing most of our treatments on chemotherapy, which is cytotoxic. We're now increasingly able to identify abnormal biologic processes in the cancer cell and target these. And therefore, we're going to a much more specific targeting of abnormal processes. And often, these agents are cytostatic rather than cytotoxic. And therefore, we're now trying to factor in what's the best way of combining potential cytostatic agents with the pre-existing platform of cytotoxic therapy that we already have. Let me just give you a snapshot of why we need help. This is a very simple cartoon which illustrates the problem that we're facing with. On the outside in green are all of the different types of novel chemotherapy agents and cytostatic agents that we're currently investigating. Inside the cell, you can see the multiple cellular processes which lead to eventually cell proliferation and growth. Most of the novel therapeutic agents that we're involved with target one process at a time, and therefore the hope is that by targeting, let's say, growth factors up here with a receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor, that you will have a significant downstream effect which will eventually lead the cell to stop proliferating. However, when we're designing these trials, we often ignore the fact that there is a huge amount of crosstalk within the cell, and that there'll be multiple other processes which are also leading to cell proliferation. And therefore, our strategy of targeting growth factors may have somewhat limited effect by the time we want to look at cell proliferation. Some of the ways in which mathematics and modeling has been used clinically in the past have been, first of all, looking at mechanistic models, and this has been done in ovarian cancer, basically looking at mechanistic models of drug distribution and penetration. If you recall the gory picture I showed you earlier, there are some fairly sophisticated mathematical models that show that if you're going to give intraperitoneal therapy, the drug distribution is dependent upon the extent of disease. The penetration into the tumor will depend on the size of the tumor, the vascularity, and the distribution of the disease. And some of these have been used as a basis for trying to determine how best to give intraperitoneal therapy. Over the last two or three decades, there have also been quite a lot of different modeling studies that have looked at trying to model impact of chemotherapy to try and optimize treatment schedule and cycling of chemotherapy, and also to hypothesize that giving a bigger dose of chemotherapy, if it's tolerated, may be more efficacious than a smaller dose, and also to look at non-cross-resistant combinations of drugs, so cycling them or sequencing them in a way of overcoming drug resistance. This was the famous Goldie-Coleman hypothesis, although the amount of actual biologic evidence for that was somewhat limited. In terms of the tumors themselves, there's a wide variation in growth rate, even in the same type of tumor and in different locations. Tumors also can metastasize very early in the body. For example, in breast cancer, if you take someone who has a newly diagnosed breast cancer, which may only be a centimeter or so, micrometastases have been found in as many as 30% to 40% of women in the bone marrow. However, most of those micrometastases are probably not viable because they've been shed cancer cells. So even though you can detect them, they may not actually be viable enough to establish colonies. However, some of them may be, which illustrates why cancer is considered increasingly to be a systemic disease rather than a local disease. But a 1 millimeter tumor with a doubling time of, let's say, 5 days and a cell loss factor of 0.5 could well shed 10,000 cells a day, and if only 1% of these or 0.5% of these are viable, you could actually have micrometastases which are viable. The doubling time of tumors varies by the site of metastasis. And interesting facets that we've seen are that often tumors that are growing faster will be more responsive to therapy and vice versa. This is a hypothetical growth curve. And again, by the time we actually can detect a tumor cell, let's say limit of clinical detection being 1 centimeter cubed, the cell has already gone through probably about 30 doublings with a tumor burden of 10 to the 9 cells. By the time the cancer doubles a bit more, 40 doublings, usually gets to the stage where that's the almost a lethal tumor burden for the average person. And so there's a long lag period before a tumor can be detected and a fairly short lag period after it's detected in which we can actually make an impact therapeutically. And again, this is why there are increasing efforts to try and look at chemo prevention, so that trying to take susceptible patients and treat before clinical detection of the tumor itself. But if we look at potential ways that treatment has an effect on this hypothetical growth curve, if we had a perfect therapy, by the time the tumor is detected, we could actually eradicate the tumor altogether. Unfortunately, that's rarely the case. And so what we have are treatments, let's say with cytotoxic agents, which will be administered at that point, which will have a significant effect, hopefully, on reducing the tumor burden. The reduction in the tumor may vary based on the sensitivity of the tumor itself. And then the tumor cells that are not completely eradicated will start growing back, either at the same rate that they were growing before, or perhaps even faster than they were growing before. It's also quite possible that the tumor may be completely resistant to that initial insult with chemotherapy. So I think I've already covered the fact that we give maximum tolerated doses and have the maximum cytotoxic effect on the tumor. But the previous curve illustrates why most of the chemotherapy studies are actual cyclical. Every time we give a treatment and the tumor starts growing back, the idea is to give another dose of chemotherapy at that point to keep on causing regression of the tumor. And what we would like to do is combine different agents intelligently. Chemotherapy, as has been mentioned a couple of times, affects the cell cycle at different time points or stops the cancer cell from dividing. And the idea is to try and get the cancer cell to apoptose, to basically go towards cell death. This is a normal process of homeostasis for all cells, but often tumor cells will switch off the process of cell death so that they become more longer living. I guess that's another way of looking at apoptosis in terms of trying to get rid of obsolescence. Okay, so cyclical chemotherapy, this is what we're ideally doing, and most of our clinical trial protocols are based on this premise that treatment is given on a cyclical basis, and each time you give the treatment, there will be a further reduction in the total tumor burden. However, it's also likely that the tumor itself may be resistant to therapy right from the very beginning, or may develop resistance as we go along with treatment, so that there may be initially a reasonable response to treatment, but then the tumor cell is very adept at coming to grips with the sort of insult and become resistant to it. However, what we're also trying to now factor in is that if we're using cytostatic agents, we may not be actually having a major effect on the tumor burden. We may in fact just be switching it off and stopping it from growing, and therefore perhaps causing the tumor to plateau at a certain stage. And so what's the best way of actually combining that with cytotoxic agents? Resistance of tumors, we know, is dependent upon the pharmacologic delivery of the drug itself, and that comes to drug delivery, penetration, sequestration in the body, and detoxification. But also, there are a whole host of intracellular resistance mechanisms, and tumor cell repopulation has also been postulated to be a major cause of drug and radiation resistance. The cell has a lot of adaptive responses in terms of dealing with insults, which are probably evolutionary, from the simple ones such as efflux pumps, which basically sit on the cell surface and pump out the chemotherapy drug from inside the cell as quickly as it's going in, so that the concentration of the chemotherapy drug inside the cell cannot build up. It also has adaptive responses to stopping apoptosis, and there are proteins within the cancer cell that can actually detoxify chemotherapeutic agents and stop it from actually getting to the DNA and stopping division. The other mechanism of actual resistance may be more adaptive in terms of the overall tumor rather than intracellular, which is basically tumor cells grow again at the end of the insult with chemotherapy. And the repopulation of these cells may in fact be a cause of resistance. And this can be illustrated on this series of slides. If you have a tumor which slowly repopulates, then with each chemotherapy, the total cancer burden will keep on going down. However, if you have a tumor which repopulates more rapidly, then the total tumor burden may keep on increasing, even though the amount of cell kill with each cycle of treatment is about the same. Again, that can differ depending on whether the majority of cells, 80%, are killed in a tumor, or 95% of cells are killed in a tumor. But if you have a tumor where the repopulation is accelerating, and there is some evidence to support this, then in fact, if you have accelerating repopulation, the tumor may keep on growing even though your anti-tumor effect is still having an effect. So that if you start off with a doubling time of around 2 months, and if the doubling time keeps on getting shorter, then the repopulation will mean that the tumor starts growing even though the anti-cancer agent is having an effect. And therefore, with some of the novel therapies, perhaps we could actually also look at inhibition of repopulation as a way of affecting an anti-cancer effect, so that if we could potentially inhibit this rapid repopulation and slow down the repopulation, then hopefully in combination with anti-cancer drugs, we could make a significant reduction in the total tumor burden. So we're moving now from chemotherapy with dose response and fairly simplistic combinations of therapy into targeted therapy with a biologic rationale. And drugs where there may not be a very specific dose response curve, but where we're looking for a more of a biologic response and ways of combining therapies. In molecularly targeted therapies are very specifically looking at molecular alterations. And what we try and identify are tumors with a high proportion of these alterations or mutations, suggesting that they may be responsive to these agents. Activation or overexpression of these molecules, which would give a clue that they're more likely to be responsive, and or aberrant expression. Again, if you're looking at targeting a cellular cascade mechanism, if you have a receptor which through a cellular cascade leads to activation of the cell cycle, then it would be nice to imagine that if you could actually disrupt this cascade, you would slow down or stop growth. And again, in this type of signal transduction, we make the assumption that this will go immediately to stopping or abrogating cell growth. But there is a significant amount of crosstalk, and there may be other receptors that continue to activate the pathway despite this. However, one of my colleagues has, in fact, likened this sort of search for a therapy amongst all of these sort of cellular pathways and crosstalk as kissing frogs to find a prince. So it is very much like that. There are a lot of different agents, and sometimes it's difficult to try and identify the prince amongst all these frogs. The poster child for the prince, I guess, is a drug that you may have heard of recently called Gleevec. This is a an oral agent, a novel receptor tyrosine kinase agent which attacks receptor tyrosine kinase of BCR-ABL, which has been spectacularly successful in a disease called chronic myeloid leukemia. Chronic myeloid leukemia requires cell growth to be based on two things. One is a sort of BCR and ABL, which is a cancer protein and an enzyme, which when linked up together and brought in and activated with a phosphorylation mechanism, will drive cells to cause chronic myeloid leukemia, causing significant proliferation with a pretty terrible prognosis. The disease until now has been sort of reasonably well treated with very aggressive chemotherapy or with agents such as interferon, which have a lot of toxicities. However, with molecularly targeted therapies, Gleevec very specifically stops this process at its root in terms of the receptor tyrosine kinase phosphorylation. And in 90% of patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, this drug will have a profound effect at stopping growth of CML. 90% of patients will respond, and about 30% of those patients will respond completely, to almost to completely eliminate the cancer clone. So this is how we would ideally like targeted anti-cancer drugs to work. Unfortunately, not all of these agents will work in this spectacular fashion. And in terms of trying to identify what are the best factors in terms of trying to select anti-cancer agents, we obviously have to look at the prevalence of the target itself and the characteristics of the target and how that's related in terms of causing a disease. And whether the pathway itself that we're targeting is accessible to interference with the drug, and whether the pathway is expressed as normal in normal tissues or cancer tissues. And this is based predominantly on preclinical data, and subsequently clinical trials will take the information from that and determine whether it is possible to actually take this into a human setting and what's the best way of actually dosing the patients and determining proof of principle and screening for clinical efficacy. Let me illustrate this by talking about another growth factor receptor, tyrosine kinase. Epidermal growth factor receptor is a receptor that sits on a lot of cells, normal as well as abnormal. It is involved in driving the cancer cell, and it has a lot of downstream effects. It's involved in causing proliferation, maturation of the cells. It may also be involved in survival of the cells themselves, promoting angiogenesis, and perhaps may be responsible for metastasis in cancer cells. It may also be responsible for determining resistance to radiation and chemotherapy. And you can see in vitro models that if you target the epidermal growth factor receptor, you can actually slow down the growth of tumors. So it would seem to be a sort of reasonably good target for anti-cancer drugs. We can also see in human tumors that EGFR is overexpressed in a lot of different tumors, including breast cancer, ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, and colon cancer. And as many as 30% to 80% of tumors may have overexpression of EGFR, which would again support the notion that perhaps targeting this would be more selective. And there are some longitudinal studies over the past decades that have shown that in some tumors, if you have high levels of epidermal growth factor receptor, then the overall prognosis or outcome is worse. So it would seem to be a very good target for treatment. And over the past 2 to 3 years, that's exactly what clinical trials have been doing. They've been targeting epidermal growth factor receptor. And to be honest, the results of specifically targeting EGFR to date have been somewhat disappointing. In ovarian cancer, where 30 to 80% of cancer cells have overexpression of EGFR, if you use EGFR inhibitors, the overall response is only about 10% or so. There's also some interesting sort of differences between different tumors in that depending upon the method with which you target the EGFR receptor, whether you use an oral drug which is intracellular or a monoclonal antibody, the response is somewhat different. And we're trying to look at tumor biases and correlate these with response at this stage. The other agents that have been targeting angiogenesis also fall into this paradigm. And in fact, recently there's been some fairly promising activity. Angiogenesis, as you know, is formation of new blood vessels from pre-existing vasculature. And as you've already heard, it's essential for supporting tumor growth and metastasis. And therefore, inhibition of cancer new blood formation may be a therapeutic strategy which is not dependent so much on the individual cancer cells, but may be used in a wide variety of different tumors. In terms of the tumor itself, it promotes angiogenesis because it needs its own nutrient supply. And it does that by secreting a number of sort of vasoactive peptides to actually promote growth of blood vessels towards it, activating the endothelial cells within the vasculature and through this signaling cascade. VEGF is one of the factors that actually promotes growth fairly aggressively and has been a target for anti-angiogenic research. So if you actually look at the preclinical data, you can see that angiogenesis is important for tumor cells. But for the last 10 years or so, we've also been looking at just looking at vascular density within tumors in patients who have cancers. And the amount of vasculature or vascular density in tumors is prognostic. You can actually see that if you have very high vasculature in tumors, often the prognosis is much worse. And therefore, the target would seem to be ideal. And the strategies that have been used to inhibit tumor angiogenesis vary, but one of the ones that has been recently shown to be active is targeting the vascular endothelial growth factor. And just a month ago, the first proof of principle trials, if you like, to show that anti-angiogenesis drugs may have activity came through from a large-scale randomized phase 3 clinical trial where Avastin or bevacizumab, which targets the VEGF, was shown to be active in a setting where a clinical trial where a randomized study in about 300 patients with colon cancer all of the patients receiving chemotherapy, but only half of them receiving bevacizumab and the other half having placebo, showed that there was a 5-month improvement in median survival in these patients. And that's a dramatic improvement in patients who have resistant colon cancer. So this was the first clinical trial that was just reported a month or so ago, which showed that targeting angiogenesis may in fact be a significant improvement in terms of therapy. The logical questions from this stage are going to be now, how do we combine anti-angiogenesis research with optimal therapeutic targeting? Should we be using anti-angiogenic agents immediately after chemotherapy? Should we be using them before, or should we be using them in sequence? So in terms of current design challenges for cytotoxic therapy, I guess questions are, should we be using what we've been doing in terms of clinical trial evolution in terms of intermittent schedules, or building in continuous therapy? There is some literature to suggest that perhaps giving low-dose continuous therapy, so-called metronomic therapy, may have a completely different biologic effect on tumors compared to the standard anti-cancer agents, and they may be more targeting angiogenesis rather than cytotoxicity. How do we build in molecularly targeted therapies, and how do we actually combine them into the fold with chemotherapy? And what's the best way of optimizing treatment schedule and cycling? So that's the challenge that I'm going to leave for this audience. Can these complex biologic systems be modeled, and can these models potentially be used to more intelligently design clinical trials? I think the clinical trials are going to be essential, but can we perhaps take a shorter approach to designing the most optimal clinical trial? Thank you.